Southwest Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. An estimated 30,000 civilians have fled the Iraqi city of Fallujah in the last 3 days, placing a strain on aid agencies. Carl Schembri is with the Norwegian Refugee Council in Baghdad, one of the agencies trying to help those displaced by the fighting.
Our staff are there on the ground trying to keep up with the needs, providing water, food, shelter, and basic items like mattresses. But we're running out of stocks. We're running out of funding. I myself have just been to the camps, and I've seen some of the most vulnerable people, people with disabilities, pregnant women, children, out there in the scorching heat.
The number of people who have managed to leave Fallujah since the month-long offensive began has topped 80,000. Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi has declared the Iraqi troops, that is, victorious in Fallujah, but Iraqi fighters still face some snipers there, bombs as well, in their fight to eliminate the IS militants who have held that city for more than 2 years. Taliban claiming responsibility for a suicide attack today in Kabul, killing at least 14 people on a minibus and wounding several others. Police saying the bomber approached the bus on foot, set off explosives. Afghanistan's Interior Ministry says the victims were Nepalese security guards. Algerian security forces say they have killed at least 12 armed Islamist militants south of the capital Sunday. Ambush was part of an ongoing operation against militants launched earlier this month, targeting fighters from both the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. This is VOA News. Syrian Observatory for Human Rights and activists say Turkish troops shot and killed at least 8 Syrians, most of them from one family, trying to cross into Turkey from northwest Syria. They say at least 2 women and 4 children were among the dead. Turkish military sources have denied the claim, country caring for nearly 3 million Syrians who are fleeing the civil war. Meantime, Syrian government forces have reportedly advanced to within 10 kilometers of the Islamic State-occupied Takba Air Base. The base and town are just 50 kilometers west of the IS group's de facto capital of Raqqa. Campaigning ahead of Britain's referendum on whether to remain in or leave the European Union resumed on Sunday after 3 days of mourning that was prompted by the killing of a member of parliament. Recent polls show a tight race between the two sides ahead of Thursday's vote. Michael Gove, a British Conservative politician, has broken ranks with Prime Minister David Cameron, urged people to vote leave to better handle the challenges facing the country.
My view is that those challenges will be easier to meet, those risks will be less if we vote to leave, because we will have control of the economic levers. We'll have control over money that we currently send to the European Union. We'll have control over our own laws. And as a result, we'll be able to deal with whatever the world throws at us.
Supporters of the Remain campaign have warned of the potential for economic dislocation by leaving the EU after 43 years, actually. U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch says that the Federal Bureau of Investigation today will release partial transcripts of 3 calls shooter Omar Mateen made to police as he killed 49 people at an Orlando, Florida nightclub in the early hours of June the 12th.
Tomorrow, for example, we'll be releasing a partial transcript of the calls between the killer and the hostage negotiators so that people can, in fact, see the type of interaction that was had there. I say partial because we're not going to be, for example, broadcasting his pledges of allegiance. We're trying not to re-victimize those who went through that horror.
Investigators are still interviewing witnesses and seeking more information about Mateen and others who knew him, including members of the mosque he attended. The solar-powered Solar Impulse 2 aircraft is scheduled to take off today from Kennedy International Airport in New York. A 90-hour transatlantic flight is ahead of it. Destination Seville, Spain, the 15th leg of the around-the-world journey. For the first time, using only solar energy, it began its epic flight in March of 2015 from Abu Dhabi. Get more news at voanews.com.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, June 20th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Today is World Refugee Day.
This year, World Refugee Day, we are launching a campaign to support refugees and to get as many people around the planet to sign a petition that acknowledges the need to support refugees.
Chris Bowen is spokesman for the UN High Commission for Refugees in Washington. Nearly 3 million people displaced by Boko Haram are in need of urgent help. UNICEF says unaccompanied refugee children risk abuse and exploitation. And the Sudan Opposition Coalition refuses to sign an African Union broker roadmap for peace in Sudan.
Well, that has been the position since some time ago, that the roadmap as it is presented by the government has not been accepted to the opposition.
Ami Maki Mandani is a president of the Confederation of Sudanese Civil Society, pushing computers into Africa's classrooms, and an eye charity takes airborne healing to the world. Those stories plus Marco Uman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Today's World Refugee Day, set aside 16 years ago by the UN General Assembly to commemorate the plight of refugees. An estimated 60 million people are forcefully displaced as refugees, asylum seekers, migrants, or internally displaced people. Chris Bowen is spokesman for the UN High Commission for Refugees in Washington. He says the organization has launched a petition on this World Refugee Day, appealing to governments to support refugees.
This year, World Refugee Day is coming at a time where we are facing really very unique situation in the world when it comes to refugees. It is not for decades have we seen forced displacement of such complexity and scale, as well as such divisive political rhetoric on asylum and migration issues in countries around the world. So it's a very unique moment, and World Refugee Day this year will be celebrated and marked with that in mind in countries around the world. It's really time that everybody wake up and start paying very close attention now to the plight of refugees who are suffering and who are deserving of and entitled to assistance and protection.
Kenya has been talking about closing down the Dadaab refugee camp. This is exactly what you're talking about, that countries should be able to accommodate. But at the same time, refugee situation is intertwined with the concern that other countries have about terrorism.
Yes, that's true. I think it's important when you speak of the situation in Kenya, I think the world also needs to recognize that Kenya has borne a larger share of the burden than many countries in the world for hosting refugees. It has really done a great deal to assist refugees. I mean, tens of thousands of refugees for many, many years. So that is something that my agency is grateful to Kenya for, and I think that the whole world is grateful to Kenya for. Now, with respect to the problems that you mentioned there, it's not confined to Kenya by any means. There are countries around the world that are, you know, concerned about their own security, which is a perfectly legitimate thing. It is our view, it is our knowledge that managing your own security as a nation and assisting and protecting and caring for refugees are by no means mutually exclusive. On the contrary, they're part of the same piece. So we are cooperating, we're talking with the government of Kenya and a number of countries, and we're hoping that all of these situations that we're seeing and the new models of situations in the world will move forward with everybody understanding that refugees don't choose to be refugees. These are people in great need, experiencing great suffering, who are entitled to protection wherever they can find it.
How much support is your organization getting to deal with all these refugee problems around the world?
Well, it's interesting because this year, World Refugee Day, we are launching a campaign to support refugees and to get as many people around the planet to sign a petition that acknowledges the need to support refugees. You can learn more about that campaign and sign the petition by going to the website. It's www.withrefugees.org. And you'll see there the petition that we're asking people to sign. The thing for everybody to keep in mind at this point, I think, is that we now have a unique opportunity. By we, I mean all people in the world now have a unique opportunity to demonstrate to world leaders that there really is global support for helping refugees. You know, record numbers of families are now being forced to flee conflict and persecution, and governments, all governments, have to do their fair share to find solutions to help.
Chris Bowen is spokesman for the UN High Commission for Refugees. He was speaking with me from Washington. UN agency says rapid assistance is needed for the more than 2.7 million people displaced by the Boko Haram insurgency in the Lake Chad Basin over the past 3 years. The UN Refugee Agency has called it the fastest growing displacement crisis in Africa. Jennifer Lasuta reports from Dakar.
Security continues to deteriorate in southeast Niger following a fresh spate of attacks by Boko Haram this month. Tens of thousands of people have flooded the city of Diffa after militants attacked the border town of Boso. Diffa was already hosting 240,000 displaced people, many of them from Nigeria. Belkacem Mashan, the deputy country director for the World Food Program in Niger, just returned from a visit to the worst affected areas.
We went through the main road called Route Nationale Numéro 1, which is the main road going to Boso. And we saw so many people moving along the road, about 40,000, mainly women and kids. The situation was really bad. They are lacking water, food, shelter, and it was shocking.
WFP distributed 15-day emergency food rations to more than 1,400 newly displaced people. More food aid is on its way. The WFP says it hopes to be able to feed some 250,000 people in Diffa. But the area was chronically food insecure even before the conflict and the influx of refugees. Agricultural production there was below average last year. Insecurity has closed some markets. Along the border in northeast Nigeria, an estimated 16 million people also need food aid. But UN officials say delivering aid is difficult. Insecurity is an issue, and a number of people have had to flee multiple times. Liz Ahua is the regional representative for the UN Refugee Agency.
We work together with the police and with the military to orient them to those localities where they can stay. And this is not easily done because, quite obviously, if you're talking of the Lake Chad Basin, the governments are very stretched. They're very stretched in terms of their capacity to look after the protection of those people. Things such as health centers are very few in this region. We are hard-pressed to provide support to the internally displaced or to the refugees. There are people who are not receiving the help that they need.
UN agencies are requesting more than $500 million to deliver assistance to some 5 million people in the region. So far, that appeal is just 20% funded. Jennifer Lazuta for VOA News, Dakar.
The UN Children's Fund says in a new report that increasing numbers of unaccompanied refugee and migrant children in Europe are at risk of exploitation and abuse. Lisa Schlein has more for VOA from Geneva.
Last year, aid agencies focused their care and protection programs on refugee and migrant children arriving in Europe on the Eastern Mediterranean. But few people are arriving in Europe via that route since the closure of borders in the Balkans and a Turkey-EU agreement largely stemmed the migration flow. So concerns for the welfare of unaccompanied children have shifted to those arriving in Europe on the central Mediterranean route. UNICEF spokeswoman Sarah Crowe says this new trend is very worrying.
9 out of 10 refugee children arriving in Europe this year through Italy are unaccompanied. This is a very worrying number of children. When all eyes have been focused on Greece, this has unfolded in a somewhat silent tragedy in the central Mediterranean.
UNICEF reports more than 7,000 unaccompanied children have made the crossing from North Africa to Italy in the first 5 months of the year. This is twice as many as last year. Children interviewed for this report describe being forced into prostitution, exploited and trafficked every step of the way. Crow says these children rely on smugglers in a system known as pay-as-you-go that opens them to exploitation. Crow tells VOA 95% of the unaccompanied children are boys, and most are between the ages of 15 and 17. She says they come largely from Somalia, Eritrea, the Gambia, and lately from Egypt. She says boys as well as girls are often forced into prostitution to pay off their debts to smugglers. With summer approaching, UNICEF warns the number of children arriving in Europe on the central Mediterranean route may just be the beginning. It notes 235,000 migrants currently are in Libya, tens of thousands of them unaccompanied children. The agency says all unaccompanied children are entitled to protection. It says every country these children leave or cross or in which they seek asylum has a duty to protect them from the risks they face. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Today is Monday, June 20th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Let's give a shout out to listeners on our affiliate station, Rush FM in Bamenda, Cameroon, and also Radio Hot Cocoa in Bamenda, Cameroon. Daybreak Africa time is 16 minutes past the hour. A coalition of Sudan opposition groups, known as the Sudan Called Forces, say they have rejected an African Union sponsored agreement for peace in Sudan. Ami Maki Mandani is president of the Confederation of Sudanese Civil Society. He says the group is concerned the roadmap ignores confidence building measures that include the release of political prisoners.
Well, that has been the position since some time ago, that the roadmap as it is presented by the government, it has not been accepted to the opposition. My information is that either the government has declared the ceasefire, which was one of the conditionalities, but it is only one of the conditionalities for sitting together, including refugees, IDPs, people in need of shelter or food, and then sort of agreement on abolition of certain undemocratic laws, security laws, public freedom.
The African Union plan, the roadmap, supports the national dialogue in Khartoum. Do you support the national dialogue?
I think the national dialogue could be held in Khartoum or Tokyo or wherever, so long as the two parties are confident that they are coming to each other with clean hands. And that is why the government is insisting on a prior meeting to be held abroad under the auspices of the AU resolutions. It's for the government to say, yes, we'll be coming to that meeting, or no, you have to come to Khartoum.
You said you had reservation about the decision from Addis Ababa. What reservation do you have?
Well, it's just some concern that the government, having felt that they have done all the work that they wanted to do politically with their political parties and their allies, and that they are there, business as usual, there is the government, there is the president, there is the parliament, there is a party, and just want to join, just take the plane and come and see where they can fit in the jigsaw, which is really not a question of resolving a long dispute which has been here for decades over matters of principle of governance, of Islamic laws, of democratic laws, of international relations, and of a ruined economy.
The United Nations has recommended to renew the United Nations mission in Darfur. The government in Khartoum does not seem to like that. What's your view? Should the mission be renewed?
Oh, I think the mission should stay, because a simple declaration that we have had a plebiscite or referendum in Darfur, drawing the lines, creating four regions, in one or two regions or three regions, does not solve the problem. The problem in Darfur is much more basic. It's ethnic. It has problems relating to land ownership, to question of power within each region. So you cannot just say, yes, we've had a referendum, This is the result of the referendum.
Ami Maki Medani is president of the Confederation of Sudanese Civil Society. You're speaking with me from the capital, Khartoum. The African Development Bank and the UN Educational Organization, UNESCO, this month held a conference in Ivory Coast on how to integrate more technology into classrooms across Africa. Emily Yop reports from Abidjan.
3 years after its first edition, the Pan-African Forum started by highlighting progress made by countries such as Kenya to integrate technology into their education system and the benefits it has produced. Jérôme Morisset, Chief Executive Officer at the Global eSchools and Community Initiative, or GESI, one of the forum's organizers.
5 years ago, almost, the government announced they were going to give laptops to kids. Everybody sort of laughed and said, this is ridiculous, what, we should be buying books, etc., etc. Yes, maybe at that time. But what has happened in the meantime is that it has stimulated interdepartmental, interministerial action. And now, you know, practically all of the primary schools have got electricity in anticipation.
As Africa's population is expected to double by 2050, it faces a shortage of teachers and a lack of access to education, especially in rural areas. The forum aims to show that technologies can help. Ivorian entrepreneur Thierry Ndoufou, CEO of Kelasi, the company behind the first African-made educational tablet, remembers the doubt he encountered when he introduced the device. Some people thought we were too much in advance and even a bit crazy, Ndoufou said. But Kelasi is now present in 6 countries and partners with NGOs, government bodies and telecommunication companies to develop educational content. Other tablet-based education programs have been launched in Kenya, South Africa and Zambia.
Ndoufou
says that the fact that there are many forums of this kind organized lately show that there is a reflection throughout the continent on how to turn pilot program into full-scale developments, he said. According to one estimate, only 8% of households in sub-Saharan Africa possess a tablet or a computer. Emilia Provue News in Abidjan.
An international charity is helping the visually impaired through a flying hospital staffed by volunteer doctors and medical workers. Michael Sullivan reports from Los Angeles, where the charity Orbis has unveiled a new version of its airborne clinic, which will take the latest medical technology around the world.
The world's only flying eye hospital was recently upgraded in a newly outfitted MD-10 aircraft to take medical workers to countries around the world for screenings and operations. Outside the flying hospital, conditions can be basic.
You know, you can be in Zambia and the power goes out in the middle of the surgery. You can be there and needing to scrub your hands before the surgery and you have to use a bucket of water because the water's gone out.
Partnering with local clinics and hospitals, Orbis works in Cameroon, Ethiopia, Ghana, and Latin America.
You've then got Asia, where we work in China, we work in Vietnam. We have projects running in India, in Bangladesh. We work in Indonesia. So we take the plane wherever our gap analysis, wherever the needs analysis says we can be of help.
More than 285 million people around the world are visually impaired, most in low-income countries. 80% of visual impairment problems can be prevented or cured. Among those helping out are volunteer pilots. Captain Gary Dyson flies cargo planes for FedEx, but takes time off to fly for Orbis.
When you see a child who can't see on Monday and they can see on Wednesday, you're hooked. You want to see it again and again.
After an operation, the improvement can be dramatic, says a volunteer surgeon.
And when we remove the patch the next day, frequently the patient breaks into a big smile.
Orbis provides advanced medical training for local doctors and nurses in an onboard classroom that is linked electronically to the plane's operating room.
We teach others to save and restore vision, and we teach healthcare systems to make it a priority so the prevalence of blindness in their country will come down.
The newest version of the flying hospital and a plane donated by FedEx will make preliminary flights to several U.S. cities, then head to Shenyang, China in September. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Swaziland edged Zambia 4-2 in a post-match penalty shootout in quarterfinal action at the Council of Southern Africa Football Association's COSAFA Cup in Windhoek, Namibia on Sunday. The two sides played to a scoreless draw at the end of open play. Later, guest side Democratic Republic of Congo pipped Mozambique by a solitary goal. Early on Saturday, South Africa required a 4-2 post-match penalty shootout to get past Lesotho after they were deadlocked at 1-1 at the end of open play. Similarly, Botswana squeezed past defending champions and hosts Namibia 5-4 in a post-match penalty shootout after a 1-1 stalemate in open play. Meanwhile, South Africa's Mamelodi Sundowns upset their Algerian hosts Etienne Sétif 2-0 in Sétif, as Egyptian visitors Zamalek pipped Nigeria's Enyimba 1-0 in Port Harcourt in mini-league action of the Orange Africa Champions League on Sunday. Early on Saturday, Zambia's Zesco United pipped Egyptian visitors Al Ahly 3-2 in Ndola, and Morocco's Wydad Casablanca surprised their Ivory Coast host SASEC Mimosa 1-0 in Abidjan. Elsewhere, Morocco's FUS Rabat pipped Libya's Al Ahly Tripoli 1-0 in Rabat, as Algeria's Mouloudia Bejaia squeezed a 1-0 triumph against Tanzania's Young Africans in Bejaia in mini-league action in the Orange Africa Confederations Cup on Sunday night. The Democratic Republic of Congo's TP Mazembe dismissed visiting Ghanaians Mediama 3-1 in Lubumbashi. Early on Saturday, Morocco's Kaoukab Marrakech edged Tunisian defending champions Etoile du Sahel 2-1 in Marrakech. In rugby news, Kenya pipped their hosts Brazil 18-17 in the Cup of Hemispheres played in Ampala on Friday night. This first-ever 15-a-side test match between Brazil and Kenya was played in a stadium which physically straddles the equator, just like Brazil and Kenya also physically straddle the equator. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Monday morning, June 20th.
Good morning. I'm Thomas Samuel Gembra, Executive Director of Campaign for African Progress, commenting from Warrington, Delta State, Nigeria. Human rights, conflict and stability in Africa. The place of human rights in the peaceful and secure society was captured by framers of the UN Charter. The report of a study the UN Security Council mandated the UN Human Rights Commission to do thousands of conflicts around the world showed that unresolved human rights violations are the sources of much of global conflict. All the African leaders to see every section of their country as their village and everybody in it, their brothers and sisters. We should ensure protection of human rights and partner the citizens for national security that to be in this nation. God bless you.
Well, thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari has returned to Abuja after almost 2 weeks in Britain, where he was treated for an ear infection. The 73-year-old flew to London on June 6 to see an ear, nose, and throat specialist after two doctors in Nigeria recommended further evaluation as a precaution. His staff said Buhari initially was scheduled to return to Nigeria on Thursday. His delayed return prompted concerns about his health problems, which come at a sensitive time for the country as it grapples with the security threat from Boko Haram Islamists and economic difficulties. And that's it for this Monday, June 20th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as sports editor Mark Oldman, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Barton, Washington, wishing everyone in Africa a very good week.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
Next on Let's Talk, dual citizenship. Would you consider acquiring the citizenship of another country? Join host Sunday Shumari and his guests discussing dual citizenship. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
VOAAfrica.com.
News, features, music from Africa and around the world. You want it? We have it on VOAAfrica.com.
VOAAfrica.com.
All day, all night.